This is The Takeaway for Thursday, August 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute, and this week, Todd Zwillick is back on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, a look at the origins of Confederate monuments and the truths and falsehoods of teaching Civil War history in this country. But we begin with a challenge to false statements coming from the highest office in the land. As of August 21st, President Trump has made 1,057 false and misleading claims since his inauguration. That's according to the Washington Post, which has been tracking public statements by the president since his inauguration. The claims cover everything from trade.
We have trade deficits with almost every country.
To job creation.
I've created over 1 million jobs since I'm president.
And they are often very easy to confirm or deny. We do not have trade deficits with almost every country. And while the economy has added 1 million jobs since Trump's inauguration, economists say it's extremely misleading to credit that number to the president himself. Glenn Kessler is a Washington Post reporter and author of the Fact Checker column. He says what started as a small project at the start of the administration has evolved into a year-long mission to bring the American public the truth. Readers can decide what to do with it.
We've been tracking this from the very beginning. It started as a 100-day project when he racked up nearly 500 misstatements or false claims. And then readers asked us to keep going, so we decided to do it for a full year.
It's been interesting to see how the Washington Post has made the decision to use the term false and misleading claims, whereas some of the networks have put the word lies into their chyrons that run along the bottom of their screen. I'm thinking of CNN. What is the rule and the reasoning that you used at the Post to decide what word to use to apply to these statements?
Well, this was a decision made at the very top levels by the top editor, Marty Baron, which was not to use the word lie. It's somewhat argumentative, and it kind of ends the discussion about what a person is saying. It's a value judgment. You know, at the Fact Checker, we have a rating scale, which goes up to 4 Pinocchios. That's when you tell a whopper. But I can't find myself getting into a person's head and knowing whether or not they know what they're saying is so false that it could be qualified as a lie. I mean, in the case of Donald Trump, the president is very situational. He says things today that are often completely contradictory to what he may have said the day before, or what may be contradictory to what he'll say the next day. I mean, we have numerous examples of flip-flops that he has made that he has never acknowledged. And I think, actually, if you put a lie detector on the president, that he might pass it because he firmly believes these things at the moment.
And, you know, you make an excellent point there, and it brings us to his Afghanistan speech just a few days ago.
In 2011, America hastily and mistakenly withdrew from Iraq. As a result, our hard-won gains slipped back into the hands of terrorist enemies. Our soldiers watched as cities they had fought for and bled to liberate and won were occupied by a terrorist group called ISIS. The vacuum we created by leaving too soon gave safe haven for ISIS to spread, to grow, recruit, and launch attacks. We cannot repeat in Afghanistan the mistake our leaders made in Iraq.
He was contradicting himself from before. He had tweeted and said publicly so many times that we shouldn't be sending more troops to Afghanistan.
You know, at some point, are they going to be there for the next 200 years? You know, at some point, what's going on? It's going to be a long time. We made a terrible mistake getting involved there in the first place. We had real brilliant thinkers that didn't know what the hell they were doing. And it's a mess.
And now he's taken a different tack. So you have fact-checked him on foreign policy, on spending.
And we've spent $6 trillion in the Middle East, according to a report that I just saw, whether it's 6 or 5, but it looks like it's 6. $6 trillion.
Tell us why that statement is wrong and also how it affects, you know, what he said just this week.
Well, the way the president uses that $6 trillion figure, he always frames it as if that is a figure as of just like the week before. I just learned we've spent $6 trillion and we could have spent this on roads. What he's doing is, it's not the Middle East. He's wrapping in both Iraq and Afghanistan, which of course is in South Asia. And then is taking an estimate that includes, you know, disability costs and all sorts of costs to go all the way to 2050. So it's a it's a very inflated number, but he seems to love it because he repeats it all the time. But he acts as if there was $6 trillion worth of bridges and roads that we could have built.
Well, I want to ask you, this has really freshened people's minds because the president had this rally in Phoenix on Tuesday night, which was ostensibly about immigration. And that's one of the subjects that he has made a claim that you have fact-checked.
In fact, General Kelly, who was in charge of Homeland Security, where people coming in down 78 and almost 80%, he did so good. I made him my chief of staff, right? That made sense. John, where's John?
What does your fact check show on that?
It's a cherry-picked number that tries to put the decline in the best possible light. There's definitely a decline, but it could be as low as 8%, could be as high as maybe 50%, depending on how you do the numbers, but it's not 78%.
He also has characterized immigrants in a certain way. He has promoted the narrative that illegal immigrants are responsible for crime in the United States. And what does your fact-checking on that show?
Well, generally, the data shows you can't really draw much of a link between illegal immigrants and crime. And in particular, data indicates that immigrants, illegal or legal, tend to have lower crime rates than native-born Americans. I mean, after all, if you think about it, if you're an immigrant to the United States, you're generally trying to become part of the country and not get into trouble. It's just one of these claims he puts out there. One of the secrets of Donald Trump's support is that he says things that his supporters believe to be the truth, even if it's incorrect. So his supporters tend to believe that illegal immigration is responsible for a lot of crime. There's no data to support that, but because Donald Trump says it in a way that most politicians don't, because they try to be more accurate, his supporters hear that and say, hey, look, here's a politician who's telling me the truth.
You've pointed out in the Post that the president's misstatements and untruths average 5 claims a day. And more than 30 of these misleading statements he has repeated 3 or more times. Now, I think the one that has got to take the cake here of the most repeated false claim is the one about the Affordable Care Act being dead or dying.
They run out, they say death, death, death. Well, Obamacare is death.
And on that one, I wonder to what extent he actually gets to shape the narrative. If you say it enough times, do people believe it and then think that, in fact, they no longer have health care?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the interesting thing is that during this period of 7 months where he said more than 50 times that Obamacare is dead or is a disaster or dying, support for the law has actually increased. So if his intent was to undermine support for the law, it hasn't succeeded.
That's fascinating. What about another one that he likes to repeat?
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is.
He's repeated that claim at least 20 times. You know, what about that? Has he convinced people or turned their opinion in the other direction?
Well, again, I think you see most polling indicates a fair amount of concern about what Russia did during the 2016 election. And see, what he does is he tries to say, you know, the evidence, there's no direct evidence yet of any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia or Russian entities. But there is clear evidence confirmed by the heads of the intelligence committees and the FBI that Russia, under the orders of the president, President Putin, did interfere in the election with the hopes of swinging it towards Donald Trump.
If you don't catch a hacker, okay, in the act, it's very hard to say who did the hacking. With that being said, I'll go along with Russia. Could have been China. Could have been a lot of different groups.
And yet the president tries to dismiss all of that, I guess because he believes it undermines the legitimacy of his election victory.
What I think is so interesting is that you have gotten President Trump's attention with your fact-checking. He has publicly said in speeches that he doesn't like Pinocchios, which is, of course, the name that the Post has given to your grading system for untruths. Previous presidents have all earned Pinocchios before Donald Trump, but he has definitely got them beaten by now. So much winning, you'd think that he would be tired of winning. And yet it doesn't seem to change his behavior and his statements. Why?
Well, you know, it's you don't really necessarily change your behavior when you're 70 years old. You know, I covered Donald Trump when he was a businessman and I was a financial reporter in New York. And the way he handles the facts and talks about information today is very similar to the Donald Trump that I covered more than a quarter century ago.
I find it interesting that there's been a lot of research on the impact of fact-checking, whether it changes voters' minds. And the latest research seems to show that it might change someone's mind, but it rarely changes their behavior. Now, in 2016, you reported that two-thirds of the statements that you fact-checked by candidate Donald Trump were false. But, of course, we know he won anyway. So does that mean that there's some part of the population that just cannot be convinced that something is false? Or does it mean that it doesn't matter to people if someone is giving false statements?
First of all, the United States is somewhat unique in that people, when they cast their ballots for president, they seek to have some sort of personal connection with that person, and they will vote on issues that have very little to do with policy. In other countries, the elections are swung much more on policy than personality. And this was definitely a contrast of two kinds of personalities that were relatively well known to the American people, in both cases, rather negatively well known. In terms of the impact of fact checking, my fact checks are really to help people become better informed about policies and policy making. What they do with the information is up to them. I'm not trying to change their vote or change their behavior. I'm not even trying to change the behavior of politicians. I'm just trying to make sure that people are better informed about complex policy issues, because often politicians talk in code and in ways that are not that understandable to the ordinary American. So if they read my column, they'll at least understand what these guys are talking about.
Glenn Kessler, the author of the Fact Checker column at The Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Later this hour, we hear from an historian and former high school teacher who's studying how the Civil War is taught in classrooms across the country. How did you hear about it?
My name is Mary, and I'm calling from Limerick, Pennsylvania. My girlfriend and I both grew up in New Jersey. She went to college in Virginia, and she learned about the War of the Insurrection instead of calling it the Civil War. And in the 80s, we used to laugh about it, but today, it's just kind of scary.
How did your school teach the Civil War? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us today. This is Indira Lakshmanan. Taser International, now called Axon Enterprise, marketed their stun gun in the 1990s as a safe, non-lethal alternative for law enforcement. They changed the term to less lethal in 2006, though the company maintains the taser is almost never the cause of death. But a new investigation by Reuters found 1,005 deaths in the U.S. of people struck by tasers, nearly all of them since 2000. In 9 out of 10 cases, the victim was unarmed. Peter Eisler, a national affairs correspondent at Reuters, was one of the authors of that study, and he's with me now. Peter, tell us the main findings of your investigation.
Well, we identified a bit over 1,000 instances in which someone died after being stunned with police by a taser. And as you mentioned, Taser has always sort of dismissed these sort of findings, saying that the Taser itself is never responsible for the death, that it's always other force that was used in combination with the Taser or some underlying condition. We were able to get autopsy results for more than 700 of the cases that we looked at, that we identified, and in at least 153 of those cases, medical examiners listed the Taser as either a cause or a contributing factor in the death. The second step of what we did was we looked at what the litigation burden has been associated with these weapons. And we identified close to 450 wrongful death suits that had been filed against police departments and municipalities in these fatal incidents where Tasers were used. And in about 60% of those cases, the municipality or the police department ended up having to pay out either in a settlement or to satisfy a judgment. So there was a significant litigation burden attached to these deaths.
All right. So, Peter, in the cases you found where people died, we hear about the Taser in the news when it's used on children, people with mental illness, or the elderly. In your findings, was there something that linked the people who died when the Taser was used on them?
What we found was really, you know, some of the most vulnerable people in society were disproportionately affected by this, particularly people who were suffering mental health breakdowns or neurological problems like seizures. About 25% of all the deaths that we looked at were people who would fall into this category.
Hmm. And so is the question that police officers are not being trained how to use these weapons properly? Are they using them like loaded guns?
Well, we certainly found plenty of lawsuits alleging problems with the training on these things. And as Tasers have come more and more into force over the years, there has been an evolution both in the recognition of the risks that are attached to these weapons and also in the way that police officers are trained in them. So early on, Tasers really were seen as kind of a harmless go-to weapon that you could use in virtually any circumstance. And nowadays, there's a broader recognition that there are risks associated with these things. There are certainly vulnerable populations. You're not supposed to use Tasers on people who are elderly or people who are young or people who are frail or women who may be pregnant or people who have are suffering from a mental health crisis. And as awareness of these restrictions, of these warnings has grown, the use of Tasers has in many police departments diminished. You do see patterns in many departments that we looked at where the number of deployments of Tasers year in and year out has been in decline.
Well, you know, the Taser was initially adopted by police forces across America as supposedly a life-saving tool for police. But you write in your report that Taser has added so many warnings to protect the company from litigation that, in fact, there is something like an 18-page manual that would put the police officer completely at fault with so many guidelines that there almost seem to be no instances in which a Taser should be used at all.
The warnings associated with Tasers have gone from, you know, in the 90s when their first weapons were introduced, there were just a few warnings, and they were basically all related to what Taser calls secondary injuries. So when you're stunned with a Taser and in sort of the conventional mode, two barbed darts come out of the weapon and they stick into you and they're connected back to the weapon by thin wires, and a pulsed current passes between the two barbs and causes a sort of a neuromuscular response. You lock up. You are literally physically paralyzed for a number of seconds. So as you might imagine, if you stun someone who is running or who is standing on an elevated platform, that person can fall. They can't put their hands out to block the fall, so you see a lot of head injuries. So early on, Taser's warnings were really geared towards those sorts of injuries. Don't fire a Taser at someone who's standing on an elevated platform or who's standing in water. Those were really the main warnings. As sort of the science around Tasers evolved over the years, and as litigation against the company mounted with more and more allegations that they were producing a dangerous weapon, the number of warnings that they put out grew from just those few paragraphs in the beginning to about eight full pages now, about 4,500 words of warnings, plus a 200-and-something slide user course that police officers have to go through. So there are the warnings and the things that you have to take into consideration when using these weapons have grown very, very complex. And we certainly interviewed many police officers and reviewed a lot of court testimony from people saying, you know, that the warnings have become so expansive that it's become increasingly difficult to find opportunities where the taser is appropriate and where you can use it in accordance with all of those restrictions.
Peter, despite all of these problems with lawsuits and the deaths associated with tasers, are the majority of police departments in the U.S. still using tasers?
Yes, certainly. You know, upwards of 90% of police departments in the U.S. are still issuing tasers. What they're really doing is just restricting their policies on when and how you can use the weapons.
Tell us, what could be done to reduce the number of fatalities, since, as you say, the vast majority of police departments are still using tasers?
Well, if you look at what, you know, some of these groups that look at policing and, you know, some of these think tanks have suggested, you know, it really is all about training and awareness. And particularly when you're getting in situations where you're dealing, for example, with someone who's having a mental health breakdown, a taser really should be seen as a last resort weapon. And what they're really emphasizing now is they're going back, in a way, to a time when police officers used talk and communication skills and took more time to try to control situations and sort of what they call de-escalate them so that you don't have to use a weapon. And if you do have to use a weapon, you know, taser has been pushed sort of deeper into what they call the use of force continuum, closer to, you know, where you might consider a firearm and further away from things like pepper spray and batons and stuff like that.
Peter Eisler, National Affairs Correspondent for Reuters, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the aftermath of Wednesday's airstrike in Yemen that hit a hotel near the capital Sana'a, killing at least 40 people. The attack was carried out by Saudi-led forces who have been fighting the Houthi rebels since 2015 in Yemen's civil war. Saudi Arabia is by far the largest buyer of U.S. weapons, and the UN estimates that conflict has killed 10,000 civilians. In June, the U.S. Congress narrowly approved a $500 million arms deal with Saudi Arabia in a close vote that reflected rising concerns over human rights and civilian casualties linked to the Saudi-led war. Ryan Goodman is a former special counsel for the Department of Defense and founding editor of the Just Security website. He joins me now to discuss America's role in Yemen's war. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
How seriously are the White House and Congress weighing human rights concerns or incidents like yesterday's killing of dozens of civilians, possibly using our weapons?
It's a very serious concern. It was taken very seriously also by the prior administration because some of these weapons actually end up at the site of the attack. So it implicates the United States morally. It implicates the United States in terms of policy that the local population might see a strike that results in the deaths of many civilians. And then lo and behold, it's a U.S. munition that is present at the site. So it really does have our footprint there in these kinds of situations. So that's one of the reasons it's raised a huge amount of concern on the Hill as of recently, and has raised many concerns in the administration, at least in the recent past.
Well, the Trump administration has touted improved U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia after that notoriously frosty period under President Obama. And President Trump has talked about this $110 billion deal with Saudi Arabia. What is that about? Is that new money, additional weapons that we're selling to them?
There's a big question here as to how much of that is real. And the important thing to also kind of consider is that package was touted right before the Senate vote, which meant that it looked tantalizing to the arms industry and it would be harder for senators to vote against that particular sale because they're thinking, oh my goodness, of course, these are many American jobs that are within the states of many of these senators. That influences these votes, obviously, in many respects. So they were thinking $110 billion, that's a huge amount. It's hard to vote against that.
Is the U.S. guilty of violating international law by selling arms to Saudi Arabia, knowing that they are being used in strikes that are killing civilians? And is there something else that the Defense Department can be doing in future to prevent our weapons from being used this way?
Under international law, the United States runs a high legal risk of violating international law by knowingly providing aid or assistance to another state engaging in serious humanitarian law violations. There's even a further implication, which is criminal liability. The Justice Department in 1994 issued a legal opinion that said when the United States aids another state in engaging in severe crimes, that that could constitute liability as aiding and abettors to a war crime. So that's what we're dealing with here. And the interesting part of this that I think is important to underscore is that it doesn't necessarily turn on whether or not the Saudis are deliberately targeting civilians. If they are recklessly hitting civilians time and again, that would also constitute a war crime.
Ryan Goodman, former special counsel for the Department of Defense and founder of Just Security website. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Military families move a lot, and that makes it hard for the wives and husbands of the nearly 500,000 active duty service members to hold steady jobs. A study from last year found 18% of military spouses are unemployed, and nearly 40% are underemployed, working below their level of education or making 20% less than their civilian counterparts. This disparity can take a toll on military families, their earning power, and the economy overall. Sarah Harris is a contributor to North Country Public Radio. In this story for the American Homefront Project, Sarah went to Watertown, New York, near Army Post Fort Drum.
When Ann Schoens describes her career, she uses the word imagine a lot. In college, Schoens studied music education.
I had always imagined myself being a music teacher. When my husband joined the Army, I spent our first duty station getting a post-baccalaureate teacher certification for Texas.
But Schoens and her husband didn't stay in Texas. He was transferred to another base, and her career as a teacher didn't take off. Schoens tried other jobs. She even joined the Army herself for a while. She has a master's in adult educational technology, and she's on the job market in Watertown. But at 30, with two young daughters and a husband who's still in the military, it's been a challenge to establish a civilian career.
I'm kind of trying to imagine maybe becoming a human resources training and developer so I can utilize my education background, but I don't have a lot of versatility in what I can do just based on the location that I end up in.
Schoens' husband will be transferred to Fort Lee, Virginia this winter, and that's left her in a tough spot. Should she get a short-term job, or should she wait another 6 months until they move?
You don't have those connections that help you find jobs. You're at the bottom of the list for child care. You have all these structural problems that are impeding you from getting going.
That's Kathy Roth Duque, CEO of Blue Star Families, a military family advocacy group. She says Schoens' story is not uncommon among military spouses, the vast majority of whom are women. According to the RAND Corporation, military spouses are about 1.5 times more likely to be unemployed than their civilian counterparts, and spouses that do have jobs are often underemployed. Roth Duque says it costs the U.S. economy approximately $1 billion a year in lost wages and spending. And it places a big burden on military families.
We're asking people to sacrifice twice. We're asking them to sacrifice by risking their lives, or we're asking them to sacrifice by having half the household income that their neighbor has. And that's too much to ask.
Hi, Sarah.
Nice to meet you, Liza.
Nice to meet you. These are my kids.
Hey, guys.
Entrepreneur and Watertown military spouse Liza Rodewald was already working from home as a software developer when her husband joined the Army. When they moved to Fort Campbell, Kentucky for his job, she noticed something about the women in her new neighborhood.
They were highly educated. We had architects and accountants, and they were struggling with employment because they had moved so many times.
So when a friend asked her if she wanted to help start a military spouse job site, she jumped at the chance. Together, they co-founded Hire Mad Skills, a company that places military spouses in remote jobs so they can work from home and keep their jobs when they move.
And you know, as an employer, if you're trying to hire somebody, you need somebody who can roll with it, who can jump right in. And military spouses, just by default, are like that because they're just thrown into situations.
This past year, Hire Mad Skills placed 75 military spouses in remote jobs in fields like IT, sales, and marketing. Rodewald says it's a start. But both she and Blue Star Family CEO Kathy Roth Duque say really fixing the military spouse employment issue requires policy change, like making it easier to transfer professional licenses from state to state.
that won't come fast enough for people like Ann Schoens. For now, Schoens is enrolled in a human resources training program at Fort Drum. She's put her resume on HireMad Skills and beefed up her LinkedIn profile, and she's hoping for the best.
I am leaving myself very open, but I'm also trying to develop my soft skills as much as I can to be ready when the opportunity comes.
She hopes that opportunity will come soon, maybe as a remote job. That way, another military move won't stop her from building her career. I'm Sarah Harris in Watertown, New York.
Sarah Harris is a contributor to North Country Public Radio and the American Homefront Project. On Wednesday afternoon in Charlottesville, Virginia, a handful of onlookers cheered as city workers covered statues of Confederate General Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson in black shrouds, a week and a half after protests shook the city and continue to reverberate across the country. The uproar has forced communities from Austin, Texas to Baltimore, Maryland to consider who and what is memorialized in their public spaces, and over 20 statues have since been removed. One statue under consideration for removal is on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where 800 people gathered to protest this week. It's also home to historian Fitz Brundage, the history department chair at UNC and the author of The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory. Brundage has studied how Civil War statues came to be and their political and cultural intent. He says there are four distinct periods in the creation of Confederate memorials.
The first period was the few decades after the Civil War, but those monuments that they built during the late 60s, the 1870s, 1880s, into the 1890s typically were placed in cemeteries, and they were monuments intended to commemorate literally the lives of Confederates who died in the cause. Then between 1890 and about 1930, there was the great explosion of monument building by groups that were organized to commemorate the Confederate cause in general, and including through monuments. These were organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the United Confederate Veterans, and they built the bulk of the monuments that we're currently talking about, the ones that are in prominent, conspicuous public space and that loom large on the kind of commemorative landscape of the American South and elsewhere. Then between 1930 roughly and 1970, there weren't a lot of monuments put up, but it was more often during that period of time that, for example, high schools and public schools would be named after Confederates, street names were after Confederates. Then, starting in the 1970s, but particularly accelerating in the last two decades, there have been new Confederate monuments put up. And these monuments tend to be more modest, and they're located typically on battlefields or historic sites where they're not particularly controversial because they're perceived to somehow be relevant to what that historic space is devoted to.
So who was making these statues in the earliest periods, and who was paying for them?
Well, let me first address the question of who was paying for them. A few of them were largely or partially funded with public money. For example, the monument that was toppled in Durham, North Carolina last week was a monument that was funded by taxpayers' dollars. Most monuments were funded by private groups who raised the money and then gifted or loaned the monument to whatever city government or state government they gave it to. And so they are private monuments or privately funded monuments that are then put in public space. Now, with regards to who made them, that varies over time. Some of the early monuments were produced in classic sort of Victorian funeral art form. Then when we get to the great boom period of building of monuments between 1890 and 1930, then we get to the world of truly commercialized Civil War commemoration. And so by the early 20th century, you could literally look in catalogs for the monument-making industry, and there were such catalogs, and you could say, well, this company in Chicago has a Confederate memorial I really like. And you would send them their money, and they'd put the Confederate monument on the train from Chicago, and you and whatever town in South Carolina would unload it from the train and erect it.
Hmm. Well, you've counted over 1,000 of these Confederate memorials nationwide. We've all heard of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. Who are some of the other personalities who are memorialized, and who are those who are most controversial today?
As you say, there are certainly monuments to Robert E. Lee. Nathan Bedford Forrest is a favorite in certain parts of the South, especially Tennessee.
Who was a Confederate general and also a Klansman.
Absolutely right. Perhaps the most controversial of all. But most of the monuments are to common Confederate soldiers. Those are the monuments that we think of as standing in front of Confederate courthouses.
So briefly, one of those controversial monuments that we're talking about now, in fact, there was a protest just this week by students, is at your very own campus, UNC, and that's a protest over this Silent Sam Memorial. Tell us briefly how that fits into this broader history and picture nationwide.
In some ways, I think Silent Sam, the monument to University of North Carolina students who fought in the Confederacy, is a microcosm, and in some ways it's very distinctive. The ways in which it's a microcosm is it was a monument that was put up by a fundraising effort that did not involve state funds per se. It was, shall we say, a voluntary effort to fund the monument, and one of the speakers very clearly identified it as a monument that was a testament to Anglo-Saxon civilization. What's different about it is it's a monument that was not bought from a catalog. A known sculptor made it. But the one other difference is that the campaign to build it was orchestrated within the university community. So it is, in fact, a monument by the university that was in a way masquerading behind the image that it was a monument given to the university. So it speaks to the layers of power and privilege that made possible a monument like Silent Sam, even on a very unique campus like UNC Chapel Hill.
Fascinating. And you have urged that the monument be moved into a space where it can be properly interpreted. In the few moments that we have left, I would just like to get a quick take from you on hearing our president speak in the last 2 weeks about his objections to what he sees as efforts to remove Confederate history. He says that that's an insult to the history of the South and that we shouldn't be erasing our tradition and our heritage. Is he correct in saying that, or is he barking up the wrong tree?
I don't see eye to eye with him on this matter at all. I think that we are not erasing the history. We are doing what generations of our predecessors have done. We are making choices about what history we want to give a privileged place in our public space. And I would just like to think that there are, in many communities of the South, something more ennobling, something more relevant, something more in keeping with our contemporary values than monuments to the Confederacy.
Fitz Brundage is chairman of the History Department at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
To see a full interactive map of the Confederate monuments across America, head over to thetakeaway.org. On tomorrow's show, we'll look at Confederate monuments in the U.S. Capitol building in Washington.
Preserving history and recognizing history does not mean celebrating monsters of history.
A lot of our youth don't even know history as is.
These are war memorials that exist for one purpose, to honor the men who fought.
They weren't celebrating kind of benign war heroes. They were very clearly meant to be things that would intimidate black people.
At least with these monuments and statues around, at least if a kid says, hey, who is that? You would be able to say, hey, that's Robert E. Lee or that's George Washington.
This week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Today, monuments are part of a fierce national political dialogue. But before Charlottesville and New Orleans and Baltimore, they were part of the conversation in classrooms, too.
As a teacher, as a historian, I tended to see monuments as tools to be used in the classroom.
That's Kevin Levin, an historian who was a high school teacher at a private school in Charlottesville, Virginia for 11 years. He spent years teaching Civil War history, but recognizes that not all teachers teach the same way, and the curriculum varies too. Depending on where students live and the type of school they attend, textbooks might cover the Civil War through an economic lens or fail to address slavery and racial segregation as key drivers of the Civil War and Jim Crow laws. In 2015, the state of Texas rolled out new textbooks that caused controversy for not mentioning groups like the Ku Klux Klan and distorting the causes of the Civil War, putting states' rights ahead of slavery. The newly published texts looked a lot like they were whitewashing history. Kevin Levin says that in cases like Texas, the drafters of the more than 5 million textbooks that were printed had a specific agenda.
Texas, of course, because it's a large state, it's a large market for textbook publishers. The state, of course, has a board or a commission that oversees textbooks that are going to be used in the classrooms. And they have been vigorous in terms of pushing back when they believe that a textbook doesn't meet their specific standards or the content that they want their students to learn.
Give us some other examples of textbooks where this so-called lost cause myth, maybe explain to our listeners what that is and where it may appear in certain textbooks in some schools in the South.
Well, the lost cause narrative is essentially the narrative that white Southerners develop after the war to explain, I think, for themselves and for the rest of the world, what the war was about. And so they deny that slavery was a cause of the war. They, of course, present generals like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson as sort of representative of their culture, their civilization that has now been destroyed, as gallant Christian warriors. They assume the Confederacy was unified against the North. And most importantly, they also assume that their slaves were loyal to them throughout the entire war. So this, again, is a narrative that emerges after 1865. I think another example of this in terms of where it emerges in textbooks is in Virginia in 2009, when a textbook for fourth graders was released. And in this chapter on the Civil War, there is included a reference to thousands of black Confederate soldiers that fought in the Shenandoah Valley under Stonewall Jackson. It turned out that the author simply did a Google search, and she ended up on a site that was created by the Sons of Confederate Veterans and ended up putting it in the text without verifying it. It's entirely false. It's a recent myth. So that's another recent example where our textbooks have fallen victim to the lost cause. But this is also an example where not teaching our students and our teachers not even being prepared to teach how to accurately or effectively both search and assess information online. That's where we're getting most of our information now, and we don't know how to actually use this important tool.
So tell us how much of the reaction that we're seeing, which is very emotional on both sides, our reaction to the recent events in Charlottesville, a city that you know so well, is determined by what we were all taught ourselves about the Civil War in school. And how much is that shaped by what state or region we grew up in and whether we went to public or private school or were even homeschooled?
That's a great question. I think certainly if you went back a few decades, you would certainly see a regional divide between perhaps what students are being taught in both private and public schools in the South compared to other parts of the country. I think in more recent years, however, those kinds of regional divides are less important. Obviously, a lot of this falls along a political divide between more conservatives wanting perhaps a bit more focus on the religious side of things. I think certainly in terms of access to internet sources, technology, of course, is part of that. But the textbooks themselves, and I'm certainly not suggesting we haven't seen flashpoints in recent years over the content of textbooks. But if you look at a lot of the textbooks that are now being used in even public schools, they've now come more in line with recent scholarship, which, of course, places, you know, slavery as a central cause of the war, emancipation as as one of its most important results, and acknowledging the crucial role that Black Americans played in fighting for the United States Army.
So you've taught in Virginia. You're now in Massachusetts. Tell us about the sort of north and south of the Mason-Dixon line differences in how Civil War history is taught.
You know, I have taught in both places. And certainly there are places where you can find a lost cause interpretation being taught. But I also suspect that you can find some of this same, you know, interpretation being taught outside of the South in other parts of the country. I think the concern should be in 2017 just the lack of knowledge of history across the board. It's disheartening, you know, to hear the president's lack of, you know, knowledge of even the basics of history. So even from the top down, you know, we have a problem in this country. We're now at a time, and I think this ongoing debate about Confederate monuments certainly reminds us that history is essential. I mean, if we're going to, you know, in terms of maintaining our local communities, in terms of our ability to talk intelligently with one another about these tough questions. But I also think that this is nothing new in terms of the lack of knowledge.
Well, you make a point, which is valid, that President Trump has made many errors in his public statements about historical facts. And the fact checkers at all the newspapers and networks have repeatedly brought him to account. But it makes me wonder, you know, is part of this generational? Are the emotions that we're seeing at such high pitch about some of these maybe politically motivated textbooks that you've described, if the regional differences are on the decline, is this improving, and is the next generation perhaps not going to have the same kind of divided view of Civil War history that the adults that we're talking about have now?
Well, my concern is that the discussion of history, especially in the last week and a half, I think for many people easily becomes a political discussion. So where you stand on the monument, what you think about the history of, say, Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson, reduces down to whether or not you're liberal or conservative. Now, that concerns me because I think a deep understanding of history ought to be independent of your political beliefs, whether or not you support the president. It should be based on the available evidence and the best interpretations of that evidence. And my fear is that as we move forward, as we become more politically divided, that the historical discussions also become more divided along political lines. And again, I think that is also a reminder of how important, you know, learning how to interpret documents, being critical about interpreting sources. You know, it speaks to the importance of teaching history.
Kevin Levin is a historian and former school teacher who taught in Charlottesville for over a decade. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Ben Godfrey from Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. In Webster Groves, Missouri, in the mid-1980s, my teacher, Mr. Webb, got a kick from challenging the status quo. He taught us that, despite what others would tell us, slavery was the primary cause of the Civil War, with economic competition second.
This is Steve from New York City. The information taught back then wasn't necessarily misleading. There just wasn't enough of it. History lessons about the Civil War back then were only told from a white perspective.
How did you learn about the Civil War? Looking back, do you think any of it was misleading? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Indira Lakshmanan filling in this week, and you can follow me on Twitter at Indira_L. This is The Takeaway.